You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 24th of January 2022 on Monocle 24.
The Taliban attend talks in Oslo, but did they just fancy the trip? Why nobody wants to work in Hong Kong anymore? And just as Istanbul is no longer Constantinople, so Turkey is to be called something else, sort of. I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to The Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests Isabel Hilton and Vincent McAvaney will discuss all the day's big stories, and we'll have a timely interview with the Russia expert Mark Galeotti about his new book, Looking at the Postmodern Way of War. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on The Monocle Daily. This is The Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by Isabel Hilton, founder of China Dialogue, and by Vincent McAvaney, political reporter and, of course, regular Monocle 24 voice, as indeed is Hilton. Hello, both regular voices.
Hello.
Hello.
Were either or both of you up all weekend watching the NFL playoffs? How about that Patrick Mahomes A? See, I'm trying to do light introductory sports badinage. Anybody?
I think I may have mentioned before that I am almost a sport-free zone. But now you've brought up what I believe is American football.
It is American football.
Perhaps
well
you
done.
Could explain the rules.
That would end up being an extremely long show, I suspect, and possibly one deviating from the running order set out in this script here in front of me.
Another disappointment.
He said, rustling. That would actually be quite a good show. Man attempts to explain American football to Isabel. I'd listen to that. Vincent, were you watching? Or am I completely on my... They were all four amazing games, but last night's was total hair-on-fire madness. It was fabulous.
I do quite like NFL, and I have been to some games here in London and at Tottenham Stadium and at Wembley, but I was working overnight over the weekend, so I missed them, I'm afraid.
Okay, I'm not going to tell you who won, but go and look at the highlights.
Okay.
And seriously, anybody, even if you do know,
but
who
I was,
won.
I did see a bit of the coverage there. It was pretty astonished. CNN's main breakfast program this morning, I turned it on, expecting Ukraine to be the lead, obviously, and no, the NFL was the lead, and then Ukraine, which I just thought was just incredible.
See, Ukraine should have had a team.
Exactly.
See, I would laugh at that, except we, a news program, have literally just led with it, and now. Seamlessly, we're going to Afghanistan, or at least via Oslo, where it has just gone. 1902, emissaries of the Taliban government are in Norway, beginning 3 days of meetings with Western diplomats. The Taliban want the unfreezing of nearly $10 billion worth of Afghan assets held by Western powers. Western powers want the Taliban to behave markedly less like the Taliban. The Taliban delegation, led by acting Foreign Minister Amir Khan Muttaqi, will also meet with representatives of civil society groups, including women's rights activists. Well, earlier today on The Globalist, we heard from Trine Eilertsen, editor-in-chief of Aftenposten in Oslo. Here's what she had to say about how Norwegians feel about the talks.
I think it's quite difficult for many people. I mean, Norway participated in the wars in Afghanistan, and Norwegian lives have been lost there, and many look at Taliban as terrorists. And do we negotiate with terrorists is one question. And of course, in 2008, Taliban, actually the brother of one of the men in this delegation, he participated in an attack on Jonas Gahr Støre, the Norwegian prime minister now, who was then a foreign minister, at a hotel in Afghanistan, in Kabul. So many people are quite, you know, agitated thinking about the fact that these people are now coming to Oslo on a private jet, living at a nice hotel in the capital and performing these talks.
That was the journalist Trine Eilertsen speaking to us from Oslo on this morning's Globalist. Joining me now from Milan is Haroon Rahimi, an analyst and former law professor at the American University of Afghanistan, who recently left his home country to work as a visiting professor of law at Bocconi University. Haroon, first of all, how seriously do you think the Taliban are taking these talks? Are they actually interested in engaging, or are these just motions through which they think they have to be seen to go?
That is the real question. There are not many indications that the Taliban are willing to make major concessions or even important concessions in order to make sure that these talks produce some sort of compromise. they were unwilling to make concessions even when the situation on the ground was very different when they were negotiating in Doha and there was an Afghan government in place. It's a continuation of a series of meetings that are happening with different level of visibility and with different kind of participants around the world. So there is a pattern of engagement emerging. But the people who participate in these meetings are generally saying that the Taliban come in saying that they are going to basically do what they have said they would do. And they are not willing to be that much more concrete, and they're not willing to show a lot of compromise. In this particular meeting in Oslo, there was supposed to be a plan exchanged and some sort of document produced. We haven't heard much about it. But in absence of a concrete outcome, it is more likely to be what you said, just the Taliban trying to appear to be engaging with the opposition as a way to mitigate international pressure and possibly extract concessions on frozen assets, sanction mitigation, and possibly international recognition.
At issue here, of course, is this $10 billion US give or take in frozen assets held in the United States and elsewhere in the West. Do you have any sense on what realistic leverage might be purchased with that amount of money? Is there anything the Taliban can be persuaded to concede in return for that cash?
I mean, that is one of the major levers that the international community holds against Taliban. But the problem is that withholding those funds is hurting Afghans a lot more than it's hurting Taliban. And the Taliban actually are using the situation as a way to deflect responsibility, saying that the things are getting worse not because of Taliban actions, but because the vengeful, as they portray it, actions by international community that they say are trying to punish the Afghan people. So in terms of whether it's going to actually result in modification of Taliban behavior, there's a big question mark. The international community is not holding all the hands just because they are holding the funds, because the situation on the ground is very dire, and Taliban are not willing to do what many want them to do in order to mitigate the situation, because they think that they can avoid responsibility and shift it to the international community by pointing to the facts that the funds are being frozen.
But even if those funds were to be released in return for whatever concessions the Taliban might make, is there any means by which anybody can ensure that that money is actually spent on Afghans who, as you correctly point out, are suffering through a dreadful winter, or that the Taliban will stick to whatever promises they make?
It is a bit complicated because some of that money is private banks' money held in the Afghanistan central bank accounts outside of the central bank reserve, foreign reserve. So some of it is just private depositors' money, around $1 billion of it. The rest of it is supposed to be a reserve as a way to back Afghanistan currency. It's not really government budget that would be spent. But if it's released unconditionally and is given to the control of the Afghanistan Central Bank, there is a possibility that they would siphon the money out, auctioning it into market and in order to stabilize the currency, but also directing it towards some of their own purposes. The risk cannot be eliminated. But there are reasonable steps that can be taken to ensure that those possibilities are actually managed to a reasonable extent. For example, the central bank can be maintained as an independent entity. Under the law, it's supposed to be an independent entity. Taliban haven't changed the law yet. They just appointed their own governor in charge. There are many committees, including a supervision committee, that are still intact, like there are previous members still present. So there are negotiations that could happen to make sure that the central bank remains more or less an independent entity. And then a gradual release of some funds could be as a kind of a test to see what Taliban are going to do with those funds. And as always, I mean, the sanctions can, I mean, the financial system can always be put back in the blacklist. So it's not either or, give them all the money or give them nothing. It's going to be a process. It's going to be gradual. It's going to be condition. It could be condition-based and it could be reversible. But just to appear, I think that in terms of the US at least, just to appear to be giving Taliban money, I think it's politically not at this moment feasible for the United States, for Biden, domestic perception in the United States. So I think it's, unless the domestic kind of atmosphere change in the United States, which we see some of it happening. Like there are Congress people stressing to Biden that he should do that. But unless that major change happened inside the United States, I don't think the U.S. would be willing to do such a big steps just because of the optics.
Just as a final question, then, I did want to look at the figure leading these talks from the Taliban's point of view, Acting Foreign Minister Amir Khan Mutaki. How serious a figure is he within the movement?
He is one of the senior members of the movement. He was the person who was heading the committee that was supposed to reach out to different groups inside Afghanistan when the Taliban were trying to take control of the country. He's seen as a person who's diplomatic, who has been able to reach out to different groups and act in a conciliatory manner. He holds enough support inside the group to be able to credibly speak on behalf of the group. So he is a serious figure, and he's accompanied by Anas Haqqani, who's the brother of Sirajuddin Haqqani, who's the head of the so-called Haqqani network, and a number of Taliban appointees, some of whom are there just because they are of non-patronage ethnic groups. For example, the deputy minister of commerce is a Hazara Taliban appointee there. So it seems like that's one of the reasons he's there. So the group that is going there is a mix of people who are high-level officials, as well as some people who are supposed to make Taliban look more inclusive. In terms of what Taliban as a group is willing to deliver in these kind of processes in exchange for, like, in order to make sure real compromise could happen, there's not a lot of evidence of that yet.
Haroon, thank you. That was Haroon Rahimi, former law professor at the American University of Afghanistan. We will now rejoin our panel, Isabel Hilton and Vincent McAvaney, and look at Hong Kong, where for many years companies operating in the banking and trading sectors had little difficulty recruiting the best and brightest. Not only was Hong Kong one of the world's great financial hubs, it was also one of the world's great cities, at least if you were being paid enough to appreciate its low taxes, outstanding nightlife and opportunities for trade. Travel. However, Hong Kong's corporate headhunters are now reporting that not even the largest sacks of cash will tempt anybody who isn't there already, and that a great many of those who are there already are leaving, wearied of China's repression and an unbendingly tough zero COVID policy. Isabel, 44% of people surveyed by the American Chamber of Commerce say they are planning to go. Does that surprise you?
Well, it's on quite a big scale, that. But again, if you look at the visa approvals, business visa approvals, it used to run at about 40,000 a year, and it was 10,000 in 2019. So not only are a lot of people leaving, but very few are arriving. And that's a combination of the zero COVID policy, but also the impacts of the national security law, which, you know, it makes expat life much less appealing in Hong Kong. And there's the practical point. If you are running a business with a regional headquarters, for example, in Hong Kong and branches across Asia, you need to be able to travel. And there's a 3-week quarantine period in Hong Kong now. So every trip you make, you know, you're kind of marooned for 3 weeks in a hotel. And people are just fed up of this, and they don't need to live in Hong Kong. They can live in Singapore, they can move headquarters to Taiwan or to Korea. There are lots of places where people can go. For the financial sector, it's a slightly different picture in that, yes, absolutely, they're having trouble recruiting and the expats are leaving. But the scale of operations in Hong Kong will probably be maintained by China and by the fact that as long as Chinese currency isn't convertible, you know, getting money in and out of China will still largely go through Hong Kong. So that will remain as an activity, but I think will largely be staffed by talent from the mainland rather than international talent. And that's the character of Hong Kong in the future.
Vincent, I will confess at this point that I have never in my entire life been offered a vast sack of cash to go and work in Hong Kong, so cannot say for certain how I would feel about it if somebody did. But would a notional vast sack of cash tempt you personally to go and work in Hong Kong as it presently is and as it's likely to become?
I think you have to separate out the issues first. So there is what they're describing as a transitory issue, the COVID rules and this zero COVID policy. And then there is the changes in the culture and what is happening. So on those transitory rules, I mean, as a journalist, you if I was moving there and that was the profession I was going to, I don't think any journalists in the world really get thrown big sums of money to move. It's just you want the opportunity. But a key part of that is to be able to travel at a moment's notice. And you would base yourself there, but travel across Asia. And with the three-week rule, that just makes it entirely impossible. And you do have news organizations like CNN that have quite big headquarters in Hong Kong. And I know from talking to some of their journalists that it's become a nightmare. Many of them have spent, in the course of the pandemic, months and months in quarantine in order to do their job. So it wouldn't make me want to go. And not knowing really, it's interesting watching China prepare for the Olympics and the precautions that are going in place, but you really have to question how much longer can they carry on with the zero COVID policy? Is it practical? Is it going to be 1 year, 2 years, 3 years? At what point do they give up like the rest of the world and say, this is going to come in, Omicron is too contagious, we have to get it through our population, get them vaccinated? And without knowing any certainty in that, I don't think many people would want to move to Hong Kong. And then when you turn separately, the security law as a journalist, I wouldn't feel safe, I think, working in Hong Kong now because of the Chinese authorities and what could be perceived as going against the government of subversion. And I think you'd have to really question, unless you were going for finance and you talk about the kind of salaries that these people make, the low taxation, if you're going for millions and millions and you're just doing something very, you know, very financial, which doesn't have any kind of political risk, sure, you might decide to go. But I think if you're an academic, a journalist, an artist, any kind of creative profession, you would think this isn't worth it.
Isabel, I do want to ask about that zero COVID policy. And this applies, I guess, just as much to the People's Republic entire as to Hong Kong. Does it strike you at this point that this is medical or actually ideological? Are they going somewhere with this?
Well, this is now much discussed because in order to abandon the zero COVID policy, the party would have to execute such a screeching U-turn.
Can't they just say, look, the circumstances have changed, therefore so is the policy?
They have based their entire notion of the superiority of the Chinese political system on their COVID policy, in contrast to the disaster that is, fill in the blank. Mm. So, you know, they're telling their people that this zero COVID policy, which is actually increasingly resented in China because it's still pretty brutal and there's no end in sight and we're all tired, right? But the party's based its notion of performative legitimacy, shall we say, on the fact that almost nobody's died. There's some controversy about whether that's strictly true as well. But certainly I can't see, there's the Olympics and then there's the party congress later in the year. I can't see it changing within 2022. And they would have to devise a whole new story for 2023. Which takes some time to work up. And as long as that's the case, and as long as Hong Kong, you know, regards the border with China as the important border to be opened, then Hong Kong is going to have a zero COVID policy. And these restrictions are going to, you know, be dictated by Beijing.
I think the impact as well is wider than just in Hong Kong, because as China tries to promote its alternate system through the Confucius Institutes, through its kind of, you know, strongman diplomacy around the world, saying to countries that, especially along the Belt and Roadway Initiative, you know, oh, you don't have to do democracy. Look at how America's gone. You can follow our system. Well, if you've also got this example of that system being properly imposed in Hong Kong, and it just leads to a brain drain, a flight of capital, a flight of industry, then it's a really bad example of people on the practical scale, not theoretical, of why you don't want China and its system coming in as strongly into your country.
You're right. And it's a dilemma, but it's not one they show signs of resolving. I think they're really stuck on zero tolerance. And I think it's going to be very difficult to dig themselves out of that hole.
Well, let's move along on the subject of opaque superpowers and what it is they think they may be playing at. As we go to where Russia has not invaded Ukraine, though a great many people remain concerned that it is very much thinking along those lines. The UK has become the latest country to start evacuating some embassy staff from Kiev. It is arguable, however, that whether Russia orders its tanks over the border or not, its unsubtle build-up is in itself a definitive example of modern or perhaps postmodern warfare. using the 21st century media panopticon to turn a threat into a damaging offensive without necessarily firing a shot. Well, earlier I spoke to Mark Galeotti, Russia expert and author of The Weaponization of Everything, a field guide to the new way of war. I began by asking Mark whether the prospect of a good old-fashioned land war in Eastern Europe invalidates his new book's premise.
Of course not. But then again, how would I possibly admit that anyway? No, seriously, if we look at what's been happening in Ukraine, I mean, there is this massive buildup of troops. There has been a buildup of troops now for, you know, beginning to come up for a year now. It is possible, alas, that a shooting war may well start. But what is clear is that up to this point, this has largely been an exercise in coercive diplomacy. It's using troops not to fight wars, but in many ways to try and avoid having to fight wars because you use them as a means of intimidation. And in the case of Ukraine, I mean, what's actually amazing is the full panoply of other instruments the Russians have been using. We've seen cyber attacks. We've seen disinformation campaigns. We've seen good old-fashioned attempts at kind of subversion and espionage. We've seen attempts to use economic pressure. I mean, in many ways, this has been a case study precisely in how actually even a state that has massive military preponderance like the Russians have in this day and age would rather not actually do shooting wars if they can get what they want by other means.
You are quite right in pointing out that the arsenal of non-military measures deployed by Russia are all pretty much things considered in your book. But is what we're seeing in that anything genuinely new, or is it just old principles of deception and coercion updated for modern technology?
In essence, the ways that countries try to, put it bluntly, mess with other countries and get them to do what they want, they are all familiar. Though, obviously, they've been given new forms, new opportunities with modern age, with technology, but above all, I would say, with the interconnectedness of the modern world. We now live within the same information space, the same economic space, and so forth. But what actually has changed, I think, is precisely that war, old-fashioned war, has become that much less useful, that much less conceivable as an instrument. I mean, it's become ridiculously expensive. You know, you take the entire RAF fighter wing that defended the British Isles during World War II, see how much that all cost, and upgrade it to turn it into today's money, it will buy you six F-35 fighters. So, you know, war has become expensive militarily. It's also become expensive politically. I mean, even authoritarian regimes nowadays need to worry about how their populations are going to feel about it. So, I mean, for all these reasons, what we've got is, I would say, a shifting nature of how interstate conflict, interstate rivalries are played out.
Does this new battle space that you're describing and that your book describes furnish a natural advantage, though, for what we might think of as rogue or rogue adjacent states, those that simply don't care what the rules and norms and conventions and indeed treaties are supposed to be?
There is an extent to which that's true, but I would say it's not so much that it gives them an advantage so much as it gives them a head start. I mean, I think the reason why, for example, we talk a lot about Russia, and I should stress, this is not just about Russia, it's about China, but it's also about how the West operates in many ways. It's that, you know, if you've got a country like Russia that is trying to cosplay great power status without anything like the same kind of objective military or even economic capacities, it has to look for alternative ways of asserting its power. But as I said, I think that's just because that means that they were first to the field. Actually, the West has massive advantages. I mean, things like soft power, it's not just a fluffy thing. The economic power we have, we have a tendency to get very, very, I think, short-sighted and just think that just simply means sanctions. There are all kind of other ways we can use that. I mean, I give this example in the book of a freight carrier, a ship that was carrying weapons to Syria, and we wanted to stop that from happening. Now, again, other countries, other times, might have, you know, sent a gunboat, or, you know, some James Bond figure would have paraglided onto it or whatever. What did Britain do? It had a word with the insurance industry. The insurance was revoked and the ship turned back because, frankly, in the modern age, you do not want to be trying to send a shipper anywhere around without insurance on it. Because the West actually does have such a centrality within global structures in terms of everything from economics to culture, that is something we could and should be leveraging.
Are there other ways of fighting back, though? The book does mention the prospect of cyber attacks, and indeed we have seen that undertaken by Russia apparently against Ukraine in recent weeks. Now, obviously, the damage you could do to a modern interconnected society with a cyber attack is colossal, verging on unthinkable. Is it possible that something akin to the nuclear deterrent doctrine of mutual assured destruction could apply to cyber attacks?
Cyber is difficult because of the whole question of attribution. A missile blasts out of a silo in the middle of Siberia, and you have a pretty good idea of who launched it. Cyber attacks, even if you think you know, it can take quite a bit of time to actually be able to have a sort of solid idea of who's who. So I think we should get away from trying to think that the old ways of governing warfare work, especially because when we look at the Cold War, yes, the notion of mutual assured destruction did ensure that NATO and the Soviet Union did not come to war. But what it actually meant, and again, this is one of the themes of the book, is actually that those tensions didn't go away. We just exported them. I mean, the Cold War was not a period of stability. If you were living in Vietnam or Afghanistan or Korea or Central America or and so it goes. So rather than just trying to actually kind of freeze situations using Cold War thinking, we need to be thinking about a new set of ways to deter. And part of that deterrence, there's two elements to deterrence. There's deterrence by punishment. You do something bad to me and I'll do something bad back. But there's also deterrence by denial, by basically saying, if you want to try something, you can, but it'll fail. And you will look like a fool and you will basically lose credibility. Now, again, I know it makes it sound very trivial, but actually, you know, particularly for regimes like the Russian regime, which very much depends on the appearance of power, the appearance of ruthless control. So one of the reasons for this book is precisely to say, look, we need to be thinking about this now. This isn't about saying this is my blueprint. This is about saying this is the way the world seems to be developing. We need to be thinking about it and talking about it and working out how we are going to be as resistant and as resilient to these new ways of fighting wars without shooting that we are going to be facing.
That was Mark Galeotti. Mark's new book, The Weaponization of Everything, A Field Guide to the New Way of War, is available now and heartily recommended. This is The Monocle Daily. I'll be back with our panel right after this.
The Monocle 24 app is the perfect way to enjoy all the fantastic programming and podcasts produced by Monocle's global team of editors and correspondents. You can listen live or explore the full amazing archive of shows covering news and current affairs, business, culture, design, hospitality, media, travel, urbanism, and so much more. With offline listening and auto downloads too, it's even easier to follow and enjoy your favorite programs or discover a new one, wherever and whenever you like. Download the Monocle 24 app today. Happy listening.
Welcome back to the Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller. It's just gone 18:28 here in London. Still with me are our guests Isabel Hilton and Vincent McAvenny. Let's now talk Turkey, or as the case may be, Turkiye. The country presently known as Turkey is reportedly planning to formally inform the UN in coming weeks that it henceforth wishes to be addressed as Turkiye. Given that Turkiye is Turkish for Turkey, this may well seem and or indeed be inane hair splitting, but it is a cause beloved of Turkey's combustible president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who has said that the Turkiye name is, quote, the best representation and expression of the Turkish people's culture, civilization, and values. Vincent, my thought is that this isn't going to stick. I think if you need to change the name of your country and you want it to stick, you've got to do something dramatic. It's got to be a Ceylon to Sri Lanka, or a Siam to Thailand, a Burma to Myanmar. No one's going to remember this, are they?
Yeah, I mean, there's quite the mission here for the marketing people to try and rebrand Turkey. It does feel quite like a Trumpian distraction tactic because they have hyperinflation in Turkey. It feels a bit like when Donald Trump tried to buy Greenland. And yeah, as you say, lots of countries have, through the decades, if you look at the list, changed their names. But going sort of so slight in the name change, I don't think many people are going to be paying attention to this. It's a bit like Facebook changing to Meta. No one I've ever heard has actually used Meta in the month since.
Isabel, Vincent has suggested cynically, deeply cynically, Vincent, that President Erdogan is doing a look at this thing over there tactic in order to attempt to distract his people from the fact that their currency is worth increasingly less. But is there a genuine, like, and I mean all jokes aside, branding problem here for Turkey, in that the other thing we think of when we think of Turkey is not this great, magnificent civilization, which is all those things that President Erdogan says it is, although he's arguably not the best advertisement for its virtues himself, but because it's associated with this large, ungainly, frankly ridiculous bird, whose name is also a byword in the Western world for failure, for hubris, and for just the thing you don't really want to be.
Well, yeah, they have cited this as one of the reasons for changing it, which is pretty feeble, really. I mean, I think if they're going to change it and reassert the great civilization, which they can lay claim to, why don't they call it Byzantium? Why not go the whole hog, you know, because I don't think Turkey, where everyone's going to have to put an umlaut on the U.
Yeah, that's a thing as well, apparently.
which is going to complicate and make people cross. And I don't think it's really going to change anybody's view of Turkey. It's just going to annoy people.
Yeah, I mean, there is a weird thing here, Vincent, as well, though, because English speakers don't call Italy Italia, we don't call Germany Deutschland, and we don't call Spain España. Mm. So this is basically that, isn't it?
It's very strange to try and control the name of your country in another language, essentially, because for the English-speaking world, we can just shrug and say, well, no, you don't, you know, we can just continue. If it translates as Turkey, we're just going to call it Turkey. It does seem very strange. You mentioned a list there of countries where the name is significantly different in their language. If you think about Ireland and Air as well, there are lots of examples around the world like this. So I don't think it's going to be able to stick, really, in international circles.
Do either of you have any favourite or non-favourite examples of countries changing their names? There's two I would like to introduce as non-favourites. One is North Macedonia, who had to apply the prefix just in order to stop Greece's incessant whining about the fact that Macedonia was called Macedonia. Literally, have said before, will say again, the stupidest diplomatic dispute in human history. I'm also irrationally vexed by Eswatini, the former Swaziland, and obviously I respect the right of Swaziland, Eswatini, or indeed anybody else to call their country whatever the heck they like. I cannot get on with wacky, zany punctuation things, and they do the small e, capital S. I speak as somebody who, when reviews editor at Melody Maker, absolutely refused to put K.D. Lang's name in lowercase letters as she prefers. I mean, seriously, Eswatini, fine, but it's capital E and then the rest.
Well, there are, I think also how you feel about it depends on why it's done. I mean, there are some 50 plus countries that used to be in the British Empire, which, you know, quite understandably wanted to pick another name. Australia failed
enough
to do that, but many others did it. One that annoys me is Czechia, which I find really irritating. What was wrong with the Czech Republic?
That's never really caught on either, has it?
No.
No. No.
Another one as well. I don't know if you guys realise this, looking into countries that have changed, but Holland is no longer Holland. It's officially in the last year changed to the Netherlands and changed the national team.
I think that's been there
team
for a while, actually.
Yeah, but this is now their official designation. They have changed it in the last year. Everything now from the government is that it's the Netherlands. And that seems to have gone by unnoticed. But I think for many people, you'd still for a long time say Holland or the Netherlands, interchangeable.
Well, let's move along finally to the Chinese New Year, which is 1 week away. So happy Chinese New Year in advance, just in case we forget to say so next week. This particular Chinese New Year will see the ending of a year of the ox and the beginning of a year of the tiger. Chinese President Xi Jinping has already signalled that he believes this auspicious, having riffed on the theme remotely to the World Economic Forum. Xi appeared to believe that the year of the tiger would be a good moment to address the world's problems, though he spoke of adding wings to the tiger, which seems like it would cause at least as many problems as it solves. Isabel, is the year of the tiger genuinely a big whoop in China?
Well, the biggest whoop is the year of the dragon, to be honest.
Of course.
You know,
yeah,
tiger
well,
always second best.
A dragon, and you would reckon, would beat a tiger in a scrap.
I
don't know if that's how the hierarchy works.
Well, I think it would certainly make a claim to that. I mean, the only slight tarnish on the year of the dragon right now is that Boris Johnson was born in the year of the dragon. So it's not foolproof, I have to say.
Well, clearly not.
Xi Jinping himself is a snake, according to the Chinese horoscope.
That's according to the Chinese horoscope, not us. We wish to make that perfectly clear.
And the Prime Minister Li Keqiang is a sheep. We could go on. You're going to ask me.
I am going to ask you, Isabel.
Well, sadly, I'm afraid I'm a pig, which is the pig. I have to say, the characteristics I'm sure you'll recognise are loving, tolerant, honest, and appreciative of luxury. Does that describe
me? Uncanny. I'm a monkey. I checked this out earlier, to, I suspect, the surprise of few, if any, of my colleagues, Vincent.
So I am a dragon that I've bedded down into the research, and there are different kinds of dragons. So because I'm 1988, it's an earth dragon, which is apparently smart, ambitious, and hardworking. But Boris Johnson, who you just mentioned, I believe is a wood dragon, which is introverted, I don't think so, less enthusiastic, no, but says lacking in good relationships, which,
spot on.
That one might work.
I do have, in terms of horoscopes, some expertise of my own to bring to this discussion, which is to say that I wrote a horoscope column for about 6 weeks for an appalling Australian tabloid I was working on in the early 1990s. And it was one of those great moments in old school journalism where I got up from the features desk and went over to a very old school chief sub and said, where is the copy for the horoscopes column? He uttered a series of Australian colloquialisms, which I will not repeat on air, and said, oh God, you know, words to the effect of he's gone on holiday and we haven't organised any cover. And I said, well, what are we going to do? And he just looked up at me, shrugged and said, you bloody write it, and went back to whatever he was doing, which was drinking, as I recall. So I did. I wrote the horoscope column for 6 weeks. And I invite you both to guess how many people noticed the blindest bit of difference and wrote in to complain.
Yeah, I'm sure none, but I'm worrying about the people who followed your advice and had their lives, you know, crash and burn as a result.
It was all fairly non-committal. I was quite young and quite nervous, and I suspect had less fun with it than I probably could or indeed should have. Are either of you at all inclined to take any of this at all seriously? Have you ever, you know, invested any amount of your own personal identity or your decision-making in whatever star sign you happen to be?
Sadly not. I do know people, though, who've spent quite a lot of ingenuity and energy trying to ensure that their children would be born in the right kind of year.
Wow.
And mostly the year of the dragon. And they were terribly pleased when it worked.
We have heard from a member of our production staff who went to school in that part of the world that the school years in which children would have been born in the year of the dragon were noticeably more crowded than on either side of it. That is actually a thing that people do.
Sadly, I think I failed to equip my own children with this magical advantage in life.
I mean, in fairness to China, that is the advantage of their horoscope. If there's a particular thing you're aiming for, it's easier to land than the Western
it's a bigger window
setup. Yeah, because you've only got really a month to play with, and you wouldn't want to screw that up. I mean, I don't know if that's the case, but there again, we Sagittarians are very sceptical. That is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. A big thanks to our panellists today, Isabel Hilton and Vincent McAvaney. Thanks also to Haroon Rahimi and Mark Galliotti. Today's show was produced by Emma Searle and researched by Sophie Monaghan-Coombs and Lillian Fawcett. Our sound engineer was Steph Chungu. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London, 1900 Zurich, 1300 New York City. Thanks for listening.